This is an interview recorded in the offices of Assistant Vice President for Student Services and Dean of Men, O.D. Roberts. It is recorded on the morning of July the 16th, 1970, and the interview will be used and deposited in the Purdue Archives. Well, Mr. Roberts, let's start out this morning and do the usual question. Where were you born? Tell us your educational background, and in short, for the first segment of this, bring us up to the development of your interest in Purdue, and how did you come here to Purdue, and so on.
Fine. I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, too many years ago, and...
Would you like to be specific as to the date?
Yes, I was born in 1911. We only lived in St. Louis a short time. My father was employed there as a buggy varnisher, which of course would be terminology that no one today practically would understand. He then took a job with a telephone company, small independent company in central Illinois, so I spent my early childhood in a series of communities across Illinois, Trenton, Breeze, Carlisle, Salem. And we then moved to a suburb of Chicago by the name of Harvey, Illinois, which is strictly an industrial community. What white-collar workers there are, for the most part, commute into Chicago and are employed there. We moved to Harvey when I was, I guess, about fourth grade. And I had a great part of my education then in that community. I finished grade school there, went on to Thornton Township High School, a large and, I think, well-rated suburban high school of in the Chicago area, and even attended junior college. I graduated from high school in 1929, and, of course, to those of my generation, that's a pretty significant date, namely the Great Depression. My possibilities of going on to college right away, because my folks were of very limited economic means, was pretty remote. So I attended junior college. At that time, I wanted to be a doctor and surgeon, and so I started out in pre-medicine there at the junior college. The Depression, of course, was a fairly lengthy affair, and I could not continue on, so I combined employment, what I could find, and going to school, taking extra hours there at the junior college. So there was an interval beyond the first 2 years of my college. There was a gap of 3 years before I was able to accumulate enough funds to continue my education at the university, University of Illinois.
In Chicago or down in?
Down in at Champaign.
Champaign. Yeah.
By that time, of course, the seriousness of the Depression had caused me to change my vocational goal, and I had switched from medicine because it just didn't look possible to complete med school and internship and so forth because of the money situation. So I switched over to major in zoology and biology and planned to teach, which I did then, graduating from University of Illinois in 1936. My first teaching job was Blue Island, Illinois, and as a young teacher on the staff, a novice teacher on the staff, I, as was typical, drew all of the odd assignments.
Like being dean of men?
Well, not in that...
Assistant coach of the football team?
Not in that school. I did coaching. Every place I taught, I've done coaching, but... 1 year, for example, the second year at Blue Island, I wound up with seven different preparations, ranging from English to consumer science, and fortunately I was able to keep one class in biology, which at least related me a little bit to my major field of interest. After 2 years at Blue Island, I moved to Northbrook, Illinois, where I was the science teacher in the high school. I taught chemistry, biology, and general science. And while I was there, we redesigned and built a science suite, and this was a very enjoyable episode in my teaching career. I had an excellent principal who probably taught me more about teaching than any other person in my teaching career. literally one day in the hallway, I passed him, and he was at his usual half trot and run. And he said, "You're it for next year." And I said, "I'm what?" He said, "You're Dean of Boys." I said, "Well, that's fine. What does the Dean of Boys do?" And because in this interim, I had started my work on my doctorate in zoology at the University of Illinois. And my interest, is this is evidence, I believe, was strictly a science-related interest. So he suggested I take a few courses at Northwestern to find out what personnel workers do, deans do, which I proceeded to do during that next school year. And this struck a chord in me, working with people, this type of thing. And the outgrowth of this was that I continued on with graduate work at Northwestern and completed my master's degree in student personnel work there under men like Shirley Hamrin, it's H-A-M-R-I-N, Frank Endicott, Cliff Erickson, who in those days were good names in the field, in 1945, with my design then being that I would stay in high school work only long enough to secure an acceptable position in the college field. In the interim period, I taught at Northbrook 4 years, then I moved over to Ohio, a suburb of Toledo, Ohio, and taught 2 years there, and then came back in 1944 to Oak Park, Illinois, which is one of the very fine suburban high schools in the Chicago area. At Oak Park, I taught straight biology. We were highly departmentalized. In fact, we had, I guess at one time, there were 11 biology teachers. And this was a very enjoyable teaching experience because we worked collectively in designing standardized approaches to teaching, unit tests, and this sort of thing. There was a great deal of professionalism in the department. Miss White, who, no, I'm sorry, that isn't the name.
Well, you can
the name Jarell, I'll try to think of it, who parenthetically had been one of my botany instructors at the University of Illinois, was then head of the biology department at Oak Park, and she was an extremely competent person and was very, very highly professional teaching episode in my career. 1948, I'd had a number of contacts from Northwestern during the years I was at Oak Park, and Frank Endicott was a great influence on me there. He was head of placement at Northwestern, was also chairman of my graduate committee, and he had had a number of interviews and contacts on collegiate jobs for me, but his advice was always, well, wait, this maybe isn't quite the job, and so forth, but 1944, I was contacted by Mr. Endicott. There was a vacancy at the University of Oklahoma for what was the equivalent of Dean of Men. The title of it there was Counselor of Men. And following interviews and the usual waiting period while a board confirmed and visit to their campus and so forth, I left Oak Park in the spring of 1944 and went to University of Oklahoma. I had one bad episode with the Oak Park situation in that they did not want to release me, despite the fact that this had been the agreement when I went to Oak Park, and it obviously was, to some degree at least, critical or bothersome for them because I was to leave at the time of spring vacation, which was the middle of a semester, and normally teachers do not change jobs at that time, but I had found them a substitute biology teacher, and I guess the most critical incident in their mind was that I happened to be tennis coach, and I had a very fine tennis team coming up, and they were having some difficulty finding a substitute tennis coach, which has always amused me a little bit, that the non-academic was the most critical box in keeping me from going. But I started working at the University of Oklahoma in 1944 in the spring, about the time of spring vacation. My immediate boss there, or superior there, was Paul MacMinn, capital M-A-C, capital M-I-N-N, who was dean of students, and this was an excellent experience for me because, of course, it was my first college job, and I had a great deal to learn.
You had your PhD by this time.
No, just my master's.
Your master's, all right.
Yeah. So this was an excellent experience because the second year I was at the University of Oklahoma, Mr. McMinn took a leave of absence and returned to Northwestern to complete his doctorate, and I was in charge of our office operating a large residence hall program and supervising very considerable staff. Well, again, for a novice, this was a rare experience. I suspect I will always treasure my experience at the University of Oklahoma because I went through in about 4.5 years most experiences that deans accumulate in a year. Dormitory burning down with deaths, panty raids, handling discipline, handling budget.
You find the temper of the kids in Oklahoma to be different from that?
Yes, it was considerably different. I'd been raised in Illinois and to that degree, I guess, was a Yankee. I found the Southwest a very peculiar blend of South and West. It was a rather unusual situation, very impressive. People were a little skeptical of you at first. You were still a Yankee, and you had to kind of convince them that you weren't down there to refight the Civil War or drag across the line all the time the fact they had lost it and so forth.
I remember Oklahoma State Capitol is the only place when I visited where you had two sets of historic museums, one for the South and one for the North.
Well, I guess that's right. Also, the state capitol has oil wells right on its property.
Well, that's just common sense.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Sure, that's just common sense.
But Oklahoma was a wonderful experience because, again, we found the people most enjoyable, very friendly, and it was a thoroughly impressive experience.
There is a community discipline of social mores,
right,
and you can do anything you want to as long as you pay lip service.
That's
to
right.
And make some records.
The one thing that I think as a family we treasured in Oklahoma was the rich background of Indian heritage. We had hundreds and hundreds of students who qualified for what we called Sequoia Club, which required a certain fraction of Indian blood or Indian background, and I guess I still treasure some of the paintings and artifacts that I was able to bring away from Oklahoma with me. We did a great deal of traveling around the state to see some of the Indian reservations and to try to accumulate as much of the Indian lore as we could, which obviously had to be superficial, but I suspect my family enjoyed that episode as a unit more than any other one thing. And of course, I was fortunate enough to be at Oklahoma when they were in their height of their athletic glory, particularly in football under Bud Wilkinson, and with my own interest in athletics and the interest of my family in athletics, it was a good experience. However, this was a university in a state that educationally had very, very serious drawbacks and shortcomings. Money was a constant problem within the educational system in Oklahoma. Salaries were low. Staff turnover rate was extremely high. Many people stayed because they got their roots down into other businesses and so forth, and they were able to make a living and so forth. But it was a rather interesting scene, and at times a little pathetic, to see the problems that the educational system from grade school on up had in that state, because the was a state, first of all, not very large population. It was a state where many of their young people left the state after they got their educations, where the tax rates were extremely low, and any attempt to raise those met with very, very stiff opposition.
Actually, the wealth of Oklahoma has been taken up to Wall Street.
This is right.
We talk about imperialism. Yeah. This is American imperialism at work. Of course, I share in this because I used to own some stock in oil companies that took oil from Oklahoma and paid off in Wall Street.
I've forgotten. I one time knew the percentage of the oil produced in Oklahoma that left it by pipeline and was never refined or processed in the state. So the state got a minimal amount of return from
the
wealth. And
well, see, I know natural gas in Oklahoma. This is why I can.
So it was a. Even though you were fond of the situation, there were handicaps and drawbacks there that one couldn't quite put out of their mind. And of course, I was getting opportunities to be interviewed elsewhere. And so, 1956, at our spring meeting of our dean's group, Dr. Malik, Don Malik, approached me about coming to Purdue.
What had you done that would have attracted you to Don Malik? I'm interested.
Oh, I suspect the fact that I guess I could be classified as aggressive, and I had gone through some rough experiences in Oklahoma, and I think handled myself fairly well. We had had a compulsory housing suit that went clear to the Supreme Court of the United States, which the university won. I'd had the dormitory fire. I had a rooming house fire in which we lost men.
In other words, you had this
by the pipeline. I suspect this probably was the thing that, because I was young and aggressive, and the Purdue program was beginning to grow and develop, and so I was interviewed by Dr. Mallett, and subsequently in the summer of 1952 came to Purdue. As I indicated before, the change in title was what almost looked like a demotion, because the title I had at the University of Oklahoma was Counselor of Men, which was equivalent to Dean of Men in the Purdue lineup, and I came to Purdue as Assistant Dean of Men, and
at that time reporting to Don Mallett.
Reporting to Don Mallett, who that year had been made Dean of Men.
Yes.
Following George Davis, who was then, I guess they called him Dean of Student Affairs.
He's on the verge of retirement.
Something like that. So we moved to West Lafayette, had the usual housing problems, trying to find suitable housing. This move, incidentally, was not a popular move with my two boys, because they were so thoroughly steeped in the Oklahoma athletic scene and this Indian business, and in their formative years, and that I was faced with a little bit of rebellion, particularly on the part of the older lad. And so we went through some trauma in getting this worked through and talking it through with the family, and trying to make the move a pleasant one for them. And so the family worked pretty hard that summer. I think my reporting date here was in July. And we worked pretty hard at some family unity things to try to convince the boys that West Lafayette really wasn't the worst place in the world, that it actually had a lot of potential for them. By the end of the summer, this had worked out quite well. We had solved our housing problem a little more satisfactorily, and things looked very good. I continued then as Assistant Dean of Men, handled various aspects of the program in the office, unclassified financial aids. See, all the financial aids for men, loans, used to be in this office, part-time employment and so forth. And parenthetically, it's rather interesting that at one time, I guess the last year that we had the loan program, including long-term loans as well as emergency loans, I guess our loan total was still only something over $200,000, where today it runs up in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. But 1956, after Frank Hockema died, President Hovde asked Don Mallett to assume the role of executive dean and to replace Frank, and asked me to become dean of men. And I believe that it was in April of that year that the appointments were announced.
All right. Now we've got you up to Purdue as Dean of Men. Do you think we, supposing I let you just sit back and put on record what the development of Purdue's program of Dean of Men has been, some of the reasons why it has gone in the direction it has gone, the structuring of your office and services. As I understand, we have rather a unique situation here, inasmuch as we work very closely with the Dean of Women, too. And as I understand, you had quite a lot to do with that. Don had preceded you, and you sort of worked it out. So will you just discuss your problems and your policies and the development and so on? that you had to go here.
Back in...
One thing I want you to be sure to do is to note any changes in the character of our undergraduate body.
Okay. 1956, when I became Dean of Men, I inherited a student personnel program, which I guess in Purdue, and if you compare it with schools across the country, we would be characterized as what they call a decentralized student personnel program. And it's necessary to jump ahead some years to put this in proper focus, because now we've gotten into a title escalation, administrative organization escalation, which has resulted in a different kind of a structure using either a vice president for student services or a dean of students setup. In fact, dean of men and dean of women today are rather rare in the nearly 2,500 educational institutions, higher education institutions in the United States. There are fewer than 100 that today have a dean of men and dean of women without having an intervening dean of students or a vice president. Most of them have gone to the vice presidency, dean of students, associate and assistant deans of students without identifying a dean of men. In other words, the sex demarcation of function has begun to disappear almost, well, to a great degree.
Well, I trust you haven't forgotten the difference, though.
What's that?
I trust one has not forgotten the difference, though.
I'm afraid some of them have, Bob. This is one of my pet peeves, as I think they are... I think they've hurt the student with some of this, because they've been so intent on gaining title in many organizations and structuring their function that I think they've forgotten who they're supposed to be serving. And they've made it harder and harder for the student to find the counselor and the friend in the organization. And to me, this is a very serious omission. There are problems connected with any type of organization, but I think in administration, the critical issue is not what the title is, not what the role is as it may be set down on paper, but the real critical issue is who you have in the job and how they interact with other people and what their competence is. I may be wrong, but it seems to me you can overcome almost any kind of an administrative block if you have the right people doing the job. You can solve the problem, because people learn to work together, they learn to give, they learn to be elastic in their response, sensitive to other people's areas of authority, sensitive to the needs of the students.
I once heard a man from Wisconsin talk about the hippie movement, and he said one of the most difficult things to understand is that for years, the deans of men and women wanted student participation. But they wanted it on the basis of which class will have an election and who will get to sit on the top step of the library. But so now in the past 10 years, this is all gone.
And who'll be queen of the maypole. But
that's right.
Yeah, the whole function of student personnel work, I think, has changed. Well, in terms of the organization I took over, it was the typical student personnel program in those days. And I'm not inferring here there's anything wrong with that, because I think in that sense it was meeting the needs of the institution.
Well, in 56 we were just on the verge of becoming...
A little under 10,000.
That's right.
We were right at the critical point of change.
It was a turning point.
Most every man in the staff was a generalist. I guess about the only specific areas that we delineated very clearly were things like the fraternity advisor and the dean of men himself. Most other people did some of everything. If you need to do individual counseling one-to-one, you did that. If you need to make a loan, you did that. If you needed to supervise an activity, you did that. Well, as the years progressed, if I were to describe the basic change, is I think it's what I would call departmentalization and specialization. You try to pick men for jobs who do certain things well. I think we're away from, in terms of a large international complex mega university, we're not at the place where everybody can do everything for everyone.
Now, by that you mean you might differentiate in your staff functions between students living in certain types of housing, or between the fraternity and non-fraternity groups,
right,
and so on.
Yes, you look at the special needs of the men living out in town, you look at the needs of the men living at home. You look at the needs of the men living in fraternities, the men in co-ops. You look at the counseling function. For example, I have a counseling division now that is staffed by 5 men. These 5 men have nearly 5,000 contacts a year with students for direct one-to-one counseling, career and vocational patterns, interest and aptitude testing, readmissions work, unclassified students seeking a goal in the academic institution. I have another group of men who deal with activities. They're specialists in this. They work with constitutions, with scheduling, with advising organizations as to what is a good constructive pattern of operation within a university community. And then I have 2 or 3 men that I would say are somewhat specialized in the administrative function. You do the same thing with your girls, you see. You don't have, each man doesn't have his own secretary. This, to me, is an inefficient way to operate. You begin to develop televoice, typing pools. You have complex switchboards. You have scheduling systems for the men. You have girls who themselves become specialists in the activity area, in the emergency loan area, in the discipline record keeping, and this type of thing. So that it seems to me that the great significant thing that's happened here in the personnel area, let me insert here, the spin-off of various agencies. For example, we have a very complex financial aids division today. The specialization within the admissions office, the registrar's office, placement service.
In other words, you may get the university run down by a black militant dissenter who's just borrowed $100 from you.
This could well be true. Could well be true. But I think it's produced an efficiency that, while it may seem bureaucratic at times, I think if the students and staff look at it carefully, it really has developed better services for the university community.
But the goal is to serve the student.
This is exactly right.
Now, may I switch you to the what seems to be the next question is, why all the objection then to the inefficiency and the malfunction of student government coming from certain dissident groups, or from people generally? What about student government here? May I say that Vice President Mallett has made the comment that student government was essentially established by the students around the year 1954, and this has not changed. This is still the philosophy. Right. Would you enlarge on that?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting projects and productive projects I was involved in my early days at Purdue was this thing that Dr. Mallett has referred to in terms of the development of student government. We used to have meetings on Sunday evenings, serve snacks right out here in the lobby of our office. Appropriate staff members from Dean of Women's Office, Dean of Men's Office sat with some 15, 20, 25 student leaders Sunday night after Sunday night, evolving a philosophy of student government. And out of that grew a constitution, bylaws, which is really the foundation upon which our present system is built. Either unfortunately or fortunately, and I think probably some of both, it hasn't changed much. And I'm not sure in my own thinking whether it has met or can meet the real needs of a student body of 25,000.
Let me ask you one question. Can any formal structure of constitution and bylaws meet the needs of 25,000 students coming to a university today?
Well, based on my experience, I'd have to reply probably not in its present form. I'm most reluctant to admit this because if we follow this on then to after university life, there may be implications here that a federal constitution can't do the job. And I get bugged by this because I think one of my primary goals has always been to try to help young people become as well-fitted, prepared as they possibly can for what comes after college. And included in that, and extremely high on my priority list, has been good citizenship. And I mean participating citizens.
Yes, but you see, they participate, so many of them, but not in what is the usual channel or conform to the prescribed format.
Well, what I meant was I want them to become involved in the life of their community when they get out of college. I want them to be willing to pick those things that they feel are productive and that they can help make productive, whether it be United Fund or Red Cross or YMCA or their church or their service clubs. But overall on that, I want them to be good participating citizens in the government of their country, in their state, in their county, in their local community.
Yes, but you see, your dissidents will say, that's what we're trying to do. You're knocking us down. We're opposing the establishment.
This is fine, and I hear their arguments, but I don't agree with their logic, because I happen to believe in law and order, and I happen to believe in structure, because I think this is the only way you produce results. And in some of my professional organizations, I'm known as a young Turk, now an old Turk, I guess, in that I have fought for change. Yet I recognize that there are channels through which you have to go. If I don't win the battle one year, this doesn't mean I quit fighting or I burn down the building. I keep in there pitching on executive committees and committee structure through the voting in the meetings to where I think I'm satisfying myself that I'm doing everything I can or within a reasonable range of that. This is what I want young people to do. I don't want to see these gaps that I see, and I've worked in my fraternity, I've worked in the local community activities. There's a terrific gap here between when young people get out of college at 21, 22 years of age till they get back into a participating level
10 years later
in the community, 10 to 20 years later. Where is all that ability in this interim period? You know it's there. Why aren't communities using it? And I blame we oldsters for this. There have been studies made in communities. You'll find that in many communities of up to 50,000, 100 or 150 or 200 people run the community. And to me, this is a gross misuse of young people. My national fraternity, when I was president of it, put undergraduate students on the executive committee. And some of the older generation members of that fraternity thought the world was going to come to an end, that we had ruined the fraternity suddenly by putting young minds on there. And I can frankly say that they have made some of the greatest contributions to our fraternity.
You may remember that I once appeared in your office with the secretary of my national fraternity, and I was working my way up, and I became disgusted with what happened at the national meeting because the old boys would not listen. And I just simply dropped out. I was not interested in it.
But I think this is the critical thing with the young dissident, is somehow, and I'm sympathetic to them to this degree, I have no sympathy with them if they do not stay within channels, if they do not live by law and order. I have no sympathy with disruption. I have no sympathy with violence. But somehow or other, there are a number of them, and they may be right or wrong. I'm not sure completely, and I think cases vary. It's hard to generalize on these things. But for some reason, they feel they have no input. And this may be a natural outcome.
If they have an input, nobody knows it.
This or listens.
Our lists.
Yeah, and this
really
may be a fault of our societal patterns.
Really, what you're doing then, of course the university makes it hard, because you're supposed to come here where the student and the instructor exchange ideas.
Right.
And here they come along, they have ideas which may not be concerning the particular subject, and yet nobody listens. Your job is, in a sense, to provide a listening post where they can talk it out.
But the unfortunate thing then that follows, you see, is that if you look at the structure, and this is where we come back then to student government, I suspect if I said there were 250 students involved in the central student government, I would be probably stretching the number. Then if you looked at all of the other major activity patterns that offered what I would say some rebounding source for ideas, I doubt seriously if you would get up much over 2,000 or 3,000 students out of the 25,000 who are involved in any way where they can expose ideas significantly. Now, I'm not counting the Stamp Club and the Aquarium Club and the Model Railroaders and the Model Airplane Group and this sort of thing, but I'm talking about significant groups that are involved in the input source at any level, you see, whether it's a residence hall council or it's the council of student cooperatives or the religious council or whatever it is, where they have some impact on our eardrums, you see. And of course, this may be the fault of the system. It also is to some degree the fault of the individual. I can never get away from the individual, because that's our our bread and butter as far as counseling work is concerned. Students fail to come in. Now, the Dean of Women's Office has had a freshman counseling program for many years in which they try to meet with individual students in small groups. We've had a program like this and had to abandon it a year ago because of lack of facility. We're going back to it this fall, where we pick at random 8, 10, 12 young men, regardless of class or major or anything else or any other identification. Just they're Purdue students and as such are important. And give them an opportunity to come in and sit down with a staff member and talk about anything they want to talk about in terms of asking questions, in terms of making suggestions, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I think this is the real critical issue that's facing student governments, not only at Purdue, but all over the country. There are a number of schools today which their student governments have literally voted themselves out of existence because there was it was not felt that there was a need for it anymore. For example, we used to have class officers at each level. We went through a cycle where that almost completely disappeared. There's a little trend again today to get back to this.
You see what you get, though, is the old fight between non-fraternity men and fraternity men.
Well, that has not been quite as bad at Purdue as some schools that I've seen. Now, that may be a false statement in a way, because it's obvious that if you went back and looked at memberships of student body presidents, student union board officers, et cetera, you'd find a high rate of domination by the Greek.
Yeah, the because they do man. That because of the, their family background. But I've heard a lot of students say, well, we don't care about student government.
Yeah.
We're more concerned about Vietnam.
This is right.
This is our concern.
Yeah.
And when if this is true, then you look at the success of our international relations club and it makes you shudder.
Well, you see, I think this is the thing that's interesting to me because I've seen a tremendous change in the whole pattern of student activities. In my years here at Purdue, in my years in this
that
field.
That would be interesting. What is it?
Well, I'll have to go back there, clear to Oklahoma, where there was a high involvement and emphasis on the social. For example, homecoming. There was a real seven-ring circus.
Mm-hmm.
They had a parade, which had competitive situations for building floats. They had a house decoration contest, which was one of the most elaborate I have ever seen any place in the country. They didn't just put a sign out in front of the house, but they decorated the entire front of the house. It was a major undertaking that took them 2-3 weeks of preparation. Then in addition, we had a talent show in which they competed to have their house acts in the final show. These were elaborately costumed types of things, and sometimes a single house would be involved in all three. Well, I'm sure today if we tried to propose something like this, that this would fall flat on its face. Instead, you've seen the rise of the political clubs. You've seen this growing concern for the problems of ecological
this really, however,
situation.
Is involvement at the college level with an after-college
this
life
is right.
Situation.
And to me, you see, and as I try to say when I talk to alumni, God bless us if we sponsor this, because if this helps them to become better citizens and more involved with the problems of society, which I also parenthetically tell them, this is the same. Don't think that these things are peculiar to the universities. They're concerned with what's going on in Cambodia. They're concerned with what's going on in the United Nations. They're concerned with their own ecological future. They want to know who is going to be senator in this state. When I see young people take a semester or a quarter out of school to campaign for a political candidate when they can't even vote, I'm impressed, you see. Now, this is the great change in the whole political structure within the university.
This means, really, that the students are becoming involved with a real-life situation almost as soon as they get out of high school.
Campus queens, for example, are disappearing.
Who cares?
And yeah, that's right. They look at you, know, campus queen? What are you talking about? This is Mickey Mouse. That's the oldster's definition for the, I don't know what the present idiomatic expression would be, but I'm probably be more pungent, but I think this is the great change in their If they get involved in student government, as we see now by the development of a seat with the Board of Trustees where they can be heard, the faculty the same way, you see these developments are occurring. A student today, if he really involves himself in campus politics, it's with these motives. I think the day of the man that just wants the gold star over his head is gone.
If he does this well, then
he isn't going to get elected.
In the old days, if he did well, then he might go on and become a professional politician.
Yeah, or a lawyer or something of this kind. But this isn't true today. Some of our best student government leaders have been scientists, actually. Engineers, chemists, physicists, so forth. But I think it grows out of a more sincere interest. They're not just looking for brownie points or a longer list of activities after their name in the yearbook.
It used to be if you had a lot of activities, it meant you were a good man to be hired.
Yeah, right. The yearbook, for example, I think is a beautiful example of this. Students' interest in things like yearbooks have diminished markedly over the years. Because in the older days, in previous days, these were records of their achievements. And this was looked upon, you know, you tried to get as many lines after your name or under your picture as you possibly could. I think a great many of the students today could care less. They like a yearbook only from the standpoint that it is a record of identifications that they knew when they were here, people they met, friends they knew, organizations they were in, but not from the standpoint of having it stand as a banner for their achievements. Sure, you haven't lost all the other completely. There's still a lot of students that I think run for offices for purely ulterior motives, just self-aggrandizement or whatever it may be. But I think this is a very significant change, and I think that to some degree, and I'm critical of student personnel, professional people in this respect, is I'm not sure we always have keyed ourselves to this change as rapidly as we should. I think we have sponsored the traditional.
I heard this sort of thing used. One dean of women was talking about what nice girls did. One of them smoked. One of the girls asked her, said, got up and left the meeting, said, "My mother smokes. You mean to say she's not nice?"
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, the personnel person was all out of line.
Sure, this is right. Well, take your change in visitation hours, open guest regulations, women's hours. When I first came to Purdue, we had very rigid hours for women. We've never had hours for men, but the old saw that if you control the women, you control the men, I guess was operative to some degree. Today, we only have women's hours for first semester freshmen.
And then after that, if they want to live in a place where they have hours, as I understand it, they can do that.
This is right. Or they can live outside of an hour structure.
Hasn't the problem of Purdue and other universities in Indiana been not with the students, who would probably regulate this thing with some, in a sense, sensibly, but with the parents and with your the constituency? There seems to be sort of a Hoosier constituency that has an idea of one-room schoolhouse sort of thing.
I agree with this only in part, Bob, but on the other hand, I think my position always has been, and let me use a concrete example just to demonstrate what I'm saying, because it's a familiar one to both you and I in terms of the fraternities. Various schools across the country, the fraternities have sought autonomy. Now, by this, what they meant was getting out from under the umbrella of regulations as imposed by the university, maintaining that they were independent organizations, as such should not be subject to any rules which they themselves did not set or make. We went through this the last 2 years. I took the position with our Greeks as follows. Fine, let's sit down and study this, work it through. But one of the conditions, and the primary condition, is that you must recognize, as I must, that there are a number of constituencies that must agree. You are only one of them, meaning the undergraduate. The alumni is one. The university is another, the university in terms of administration. And the general public is another one. Now, and your national officers are another one. Now, when we consult and confer and talk through philosophically, analytically, logically, the problems involved, then we can make a decision based on this. If it's separation as a result of this kind of conference, I'm all for you. This is marvelous. The outcome of this was, as we got the groups involved, we had a whole series of meetings with fraternity presidents, fraternity alumni, and house corporation officers, and national officers. Last spring, the young men themselves said, forget it. We don't want separation. Now, I think this is a thing that's happening. Because they argue, I heard a young man on one of the talk shows last night, I never did discover just what his role was, I think he was a young professor in one of the eastern schools. And he was talking about relevance and the revision of the curriculum and open admissions and this sort of thing. And I think this is the pressure you're seeing and the thing that many people identify as dissidents and activism and so forth. But it's their desire to see these things become relevant to the world as they see it. The political issues, yes, but even internally, they want to be heard, they want to be involved, they want things to be realistic. They come many times to the university from a very permissive home, they have a car, they have no curfew, and suddenly if they meet a situation that then goes back and becomes highly restrictive, we say you can't have a car, you got to be in at 11 o'clock, you've got rebellion on your hands. Yet on the other hand, as I tell parents, don't expect us to do something that you haven't been able to do in 18 years.
This is always, of course, the moral question. You fail to teach your kid morals for 17 years, then he comes to Purdue and he goes out and gets drunk, or let's say he contracts a disease, and then you blame it on the university.
That's right.
But I know that this is one of the problems that you
have. And of course, we in turn, you see, have a tendency then to criticize the family and the home and the church that they came from. Well, again, it's this idea of going back to all of your consistent constituencies. You see, I don't think really Hoosiers are that much different. I think people in general, I may sound really idealistic here, but I think people in general are good. I think people want to do what's right, because they want to be treated well themselves. Sure, there's the human frailties, cupidity, and so forth that you get involved with, but I found that most students will listen. Most students will try to do what's right. For example, our percentage of discipline cases is very, very small. It's because we're getting a fine segment of the American population. We have relatively little serious discipline at this institution. Even with the recent dissidents, our rate of suspension or expulsion is still extremely low.
But what about your people, like your pot smokers and acid takers and so on?
We've had some of this. We just had some meetings with some of the people in the psych clinic and the psychiatric division of the health service. Their evidence is, as well as ours, that sure, we have some of it. It isn't a major problem here. But I think if any of us look back to our comparable ages and our own experience, we experimented with what was the fad then. During the prohibition years, I sure in heck experimented with alcoholic beverage.
I should say so. Sometimes to your own physical.
That's level. Right. And I had to make my own decisions, you see, as to how I was going to use this, if I was going to use it. Tobacco's another one. All of us, I'm sure, have had experiences which helped us make up our minds as to what our attitudes and our mores were going to be in terms of sex or any of these issues that face young people. Religion, they're doing the same things. I think people must recognize that we're dealing with a different kind of a generation.
Well, this is, as I gather, this is one reason why you were made assistant to the vice president, so that you could try to explain to the constituency in Indiana what was going on.
This is part of it, yeah. You see, I think we don't identify the very environment that we've provided these young people with. And again, let's use specifics. In my age in college, for example, radio was even relatively new. Communication about elections and political campaigns was furnished primarily by the large metropolitan daily newspapers. Radio had relatively little of the commentary in it. Contrast that with today. When the student not only sees the candidates on television, he sees the process that nominates them, he sees the buildup that leads to this nomination, he sees them almost daily in their campaign exposures, he hears the president very frequently in his TV news sessions and this sort of thing, commentary magazines, everybody is free to give them an opinion. So he's exposed much more. Then take another facet. I had traveled by the time I went to college very little. And it was in a very limited mileage arc. Look at the young people today, the amount of travel they do, cross-country on vacations with their families, during their college experience, a year abroad, for more and more and more.
Or summers abroad.
Yeah, summers abroad, this sort of thing.
Some of them even get to go to Vietnam for a couple of years at government expense.
That's right.
Then they come back.
So you have generations of young people coming up today and that are terrifically more knowledgeable and sophisticated about this whole world of ours. Well, this is going to raise questions. They're intelligent young people. They go to Vietnam or they go to visit Africa, as I did a couple of years ago. I came back with a list of questions as long as my arm that were unanswered, you see. We talk about our racial situation in this country. I go to a place like South Africa and live in Johannesburg where my traveling companion can't leave the airport but must live in a transient lounge because he happens to be black. They bring him his meals from the cafeteria. He's in essence in jail, you see. Well,
if you were in Africa, South Africa, you'd have to have a work permit, a card of identification. Yeah. He couldn't even sit on the same bench.
That's right.
Occupied. It's sort of like the segregation of the washrooms and pool halls that we used to have down south. Of course, now
people who grew up with this years ago, you see, this was a way of life. They knew nothing else. There was no conflicting evidence from the north that they were exposed to. It just didn't get put in the papers. Today, they see it on television. National figures like Martin Luther King, Evers, Roy Wilkins, become national Julian Bond. I mean, you're seeing a way of life. Well, of course, personally, I don't think this is completely unique. There have been similar problems throughout history that man has met, that our country has met, and what one generation's problems may not be the problems of another generation. Mine was obsessed with the Depression, you see. I couldn't worry about racial equality then. I was worrying about getting some bread in my own mouth, you see. Today, we're living in, relatively speaking, I guess, a land of plenty, for certain people at least. And this bothers young people. They see themselves coming from a fine socioeconomic background. They have the opportunity to attend a great university, and yet they go down into Appalachia, they go into the Deep South, and they see people starving, suffering from malnutrition. The Biafra situation made a tremendous impact on many, many young people. I had young people come in just to talk about this because they were really bothered deep down inside themselves that here was a nation literally starving to death.
No, it was a nation, a dissident group being starved by the dominant national group.
Right, but you see, they saw this as a great international tragedy. And their feelings, their questions were, why in the hell don't we get in there and straighten this out?
Well, we didn't, Vietnam.
Well, you see, but if we had gone into Biafra, we would still be, we'd be in a position of criticism probably that we are in Vietnam or Cambodia or whatever else it happens to be.
It's part of the Protestant ethic, though, and of the Christian ethic, to wherever you see sin and vice, to reform it.
Yeah.
And
whether you have a right to or not.
Well, doggone, you know, that isn't all together.
In their
that
thing,
isn't all wrong.
In some of their things. No, I don't disagree about it. But these are the kinds of international and national issues that are really bugging our young people.
And it's of course, as I see it, now, you see, I'm on the verge of retirement, but as I see it, a lot of it is the impatience of these young people who will go out and work for a cause without quite knowing what they're implying, what it means, and have no background. However, this is what the university is for, I gather.
But these young people are bright. gosh, if we don't have some faith in them that they can help solve some of these problems, then it seems to me that we're certainly misguided in our efforts.
Now, there's one problem I'm going to bring up that I wish you would talk about. Everywhere I go in talking to administration, I hear about the land-grant college spirit and the virtues of Purdue in times gone past, where our young people knew what they wanted to do. They wanted to be engineers and pharmacists and home ec majors. Now, these young people had a goal. They were going out into the world and become engineers. And I find certain of our administrators disturbed by the fact that we've got a lot of harum-scarum young people here today, particularly in the School of Humanities, who don't have these noble goals of learning how to make a living. In other words, the atmosphere is the virtues of applied science study as compared with the philosophy, sociology, and these so-called hippie-oriented studies.
I guess I'm going to have to be a dissident myself, because I think I disagree with them. One, I think the materialistic goal is still an important one in the minds of the vast majority of students. And all you have to do, I think, to verify this is to look at the enrollment statistics in the various schools of this institution. Agriculture, engineering, science, industrial management, home economics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that answers itself. However, I do think that you have, let's say, another group then, in humanities, if you please, who have focused their attention in kind of a combined way on graduating from the university, maybe without goals yet that are materialistic, but certainly with goals as to what some of the problems are in the world and what they would like to do about them. And I don't think this is atypical. We had young people years and years ago who graduated from liberal arts, whatever that meant. Many of them went on to become teachers, and maybe misguided teachers. I think in degree there is a difference, but I would not go along with the people who say that our young people today have abandoned a materialistic point of view, because I don't think this is true. I think they're still interested in going out and having a good home, a good family, the comforts of life, and so forth. I think many of them, and even including those that have a pretty high level of materialistic drive, are also combining it with some of these other concerns. Some of our most concerned students happen to be engineering students. As we found out when the sit-in occurred, when the Army Corps Day disruption occurred, they're not all humanities people, and they're not all out-of-staters either.
Let me ask you, is there any difference between, from where you sit, of the what to do with these student dissidents? Do you look at them as misguided, or do you
look at them as
people who know exactly what they're doing?
And no, I don't agree with that either. I think many of them are thoroughly confused young people. They see things wrong. And, well, let me again use an example. You get an idea boy in an organization. He comes in, he's got this great idea. He wants to put on some big project. Well, he may think this is a completely unique idea. Well, as a personnel dean, maybe we've heard that every year for the last 25 years. But some way, you see, you have to convince him that either it's workable or it's not workable based upon the orderly processes of the society in which he operates. And many of these young people, I had a young man sit in here a year ago, one of our most active radicals on our campus, one of the real disruption individuals. He sat here and in a long conversation explained to me how he thought the United States should be run. All it was a duplication of the New England town meeting system. And I tried to reason with him and show him that in a population as large as ours, a society as complex as ours, how, in my opinion, this could not conceivably work. He did not agree one whit. He felt that the United States was too large. It ought to be broken up into more distinct governmental units. Every person should be able to go to the town meeting and say yay or nay on every issue. And even trying to use some very concrete examples, he just could not see this, you see. And he thought that this should apply to the university as well. you see. Well, yet this young man, interestingly enough, had very high-level materialistic goals. He knew exactly what he wanted to do career-wise, and it was laid out just like a blueprint. But he still had these other goals too, you see. Well, in that respect, I don't think generations have changed. Sure, it's changed, but again, these reasons of exposure, travel, sophistication in terms of issues.
In other words, the kids are just as interested as they were 40 years ago.
This is right.
But the subject matter of their interest has changed to a really desirable and active participation in society.
You know,
in a sense, this looks good.
I think it's fine. The interesting thing, too, I think you note, is, and this has always kind of amused me, favorably, of course, you watch the seniors. Take just the top student leaders that we probably have more exposure to than any other group. They're all involved in all these issues on the campus until about February and March of their senior year. And suddenly, their focus of interest is the placement service, you see.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking right now of about three young men that I knew very, very well here in their senior years. From there on out, it was interviews with Bell or interviews with Chemical Trust or First National of this town or that town or with Purina or General Mills or whatever it was. Well, anyone who tells me they don't have the same goals as they did 20 years ago, I don't think watches them then in that situation.
The hair gets cut, doesn't it?
That's right. Suddenly some of them take on a new appearance, you see. Because here they become they get confronted by the establishment.
You mean that we protect them from the facts of life here?
I don't think we protect them, but I think they're in an open atmosphere where they have more of an opportunity to do their thing, I guess, as they say it, by letting their hair grow or wearing the wildest clothes that they can conceivably buy any place. And I don't think this is abnormal. This has been the way of youth from time immemorial.
Well, this is what a college should do.
Yeah, as long as, again, it's within channels and within limits, not burning down buildings and not doing things which disrupt.
See, the hardest thing for me, as I say, I'm getting old, and you shouldn't allow me to teach, because I'm out of understanding with them. These kids destroying the institution that is there to help them.
But you see, Bob, this is another thing that I don't agree with. People, I think, have built up this generation gap talk to where it's become almost an obsession. Mm-hmm. And I, frankly, don't think that there's as much problem with generation gap. Well, or let me put it another way. I think we overgeneralize, because I think the good teacher, the good administrator, still can have tremendous impact on students and tremendous communication. And I don't care whether the guy is 90 years old or whether he's 20 years old. I've tried to change my staff over the years to give quite an emphasis on youth. I have roughly half of my staff is under 30, partly to satisfy the externals on this, to give it the image of youth. But on the other hand, I've had, and I know I'm not unique in this, but staff people across this great university in all areas who have plenty of gray hair and lots of them with not much of it, that are great sources of conversation, consultation, advice with their young people. They're looked upon as highly respected treasure sources. And I hate to see this continued emphasis on the generation gap, because I personally don't believe it's as great as people think it is. I think some people, yes, have created a generation gap. This is true within any kind of a unit in society. Take the family. There are fathers who don't get along with their sons, maybe because both of them develop a polarization and a rigidity. And I think this is true in administration. I think it's true in teaching. I know teachers that are pretty rigid in their classroom approach. I think there are people, I personally, certain kinds of long hair bug me. Yet I've developed a stance, I think, where as long as it's clean and well-groomed, I don't care much anymore.
The change in student dress and styles, that's unimportant. It's what's in their minds.
This is right.
It's what's in their minds.
I hate to see them make an issue of dress standards in the residence halls, for example.
Well,
I personally have feelings about this because, having seen my own sons, I recall so vividly my youngest lad went into banking. Well, he had at graduation a very fine collection of white socks, wheat jeans, and sports shirts. And he asked me to go through his wardrobe with him. Well, this didn't take long to figure out what was acceptable in banking and what wasn't acceptable in banking. So our next stop was a men's clothing store to practically re-outfit him, because his bank happens to frown on even wearing sport coats.
One wears dark clothes, white shirt, and sober dark tie.
Now they've loosened up to where you can wear colored shirts. Well, nothing is ever said about this per se, but there's a moray situation that you better be pretty alert to when you go into that kind of an establishment, you see. And I think this is what the students adapt to really surprisingly rapidly.
I have probably one of the finest high school teachers in this generation who was trying to get his thesis written this summer, who lost a job because he refused to dress correctly out of battleground.
Yeah.
Isn't that? But this is the sort of thing the kids have to learn.
When I taught high school, I wore a tie and a jacket all the time. Today I go into high schools, not too frequently. I always like to see the biology set up because of my background. Well, I walk down there perhaps, and I'm more likely than not to be greeted by a school teacher in a sports shirt. Many of them I doubt ever wear a tie except a PTA meeting or something like that.
It's changing.
This is a different way of life.
Let me bring you back to something. When did you become assistant to the
3 years
vice
ago.
President? Two
assistant
years.
Vice president 3 years ago.
3 years ago. Now, what is the nature of this new job of yours?
Well, what I do mostly is serve as kind of a backup man for Vice President Mallett. I attend committee meetings for him and with him. I answer some letters for him. I organize the work of what we call the Student Personnel Council, which consists of the heads of his units. We meet regularly after each trustee's meeting to bring his people up to date, again to improve communication, try to keep him informed as a liaison person of some of the work of his organization.
In essence, it is an internal job, not
this
public
is right.
relations with Indiana
no.
citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Let me come back while we're on, get it on tape personally. We hope that you will put in an appendix, you see, your publications and honors, those that you particularly like, and just have a list of them, major speeches that you'd like to give. But just for the tape, what is the biggest honor you think you've had in your job?
Well, I think the thing I look back on probably with the most pride is achievement within my own professional organization. Year before last, I had the privilege of serving as president of the National Association of Student Personnel Administrators. This is the association of deans of students, vice presidents, deans of men, and incidentally, we are coeducational and have more and more women members. This followed a long period of service to that organization. I served on the executive committee, I guess a total of about 12 years, different times. My last sequence was 8 straight years, which I served 1 year as a member at large, 3 years as conference chairman, 1 year as controller, 1 year as president-elect, 1 year as president, 1 year as past president, immediate past president. I think in that organization I had considerable impact. We developed, we admitted junior colleges to that membership. We developed our coeducational approach, developing a higher level of involvement of women in the organization, putting women on the executive committee and in various roles. We developed a new constitution bylaws. We developed a whole new financial structure for the organization. And we established a national office. We restructured the organization, so we now have a good professional journal. We've put out any number of documents, position papers, monographs, and so forth. I think the role I had in this is probably the greatest fruition.
Most satisfying.
And satisfying to me. Second is my community involvement. I've always had a very strong philosophy that I'm a product of a land-grant institution myself, the University of Illinois, public schools all throughout my life.
Did you ever know the great Tommy Arkell Clark?
Knew of him.
You didn't know him, though?
No. No, he was just before my time. Fred Turner was the dean of men when I was at Illinois. And I had the privilege of meeting Fred Turner early in my days at Illinois and respected the man greatly, and he had a great impact on my life. At one time, Fred Turner had more personnel men out in the field coming out of that institution than any other school.
Weren't you
today
also,
Purdue challenges that.
Haven't you also been the president of your national college fraternity?
Yes, I've been
Kappa Delta Rho.
Kappa Delta Rho. But I think my community experience, including that fraternity thing, is my second greatest satisfaction, because as I said, I'm a product of a land-grant institution. I came out of limited resources. I feel that I owe society something for what it has given me. And as a result, I've always tried to give a considerable proportion of my effort to my church, my community, through United Fund, YMCA, Red Cross, Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, miscellaneous things, my national fraternity. The thing I've tried to do is, and many times not too successfully, is to put back into society something in return for what I feel society has given me. That's my basic philosophy, and I guess my desire is that if I can instill a little bit of that into students, then my life will have been very, very well spent.
All right, we're on professional problems here. How do you rate Purdue's operation with that of, say, others in the Big Ten, and then nationally?
Well, here again, I don't want to sound too egotistical, but all I can tell you is, and I can give you examples. My friends tell me I'm an extreme pragmatist, and personally, I'm proud of that in many ways. I've never been one to sit around and theorize a great deal. I want to see results of programs. I think parenthetically here is one of the places where President Hovde has had a great impact on me, because President Hovde has little tolerance for mediocrity, and I think maybe I share some of that. I only wish I did it half as well as he does it. Purdue's program, while it's a fairly unique organization because we've retained the Dean of Men and Dean of Women setups, and we have stuck with this over the years at sometimes having it as a source of great controversy, even internally, and to some degree ridicule and comment, sarcastic comment from outside. It's worked, and it's worked well. Our stance on the handling of discipline, for example, has been almost a unique one. Just recently, in a review of our discipline situation by an outside agency, they said it was refreshing and hopeful to see an institution the size of ours still trying to educate discipline problems without involving committees. In other words, still trying to do it on a counseling base. Our intern and training programs here has probably, we're way up the line now in the numbers of people that we're producing who go out into the personnel field and get top jobs.
Do you find some of the Ivy League and oldest colleges looking to you for suggestions and help?
Not too often, but the other types of schools do.
That is, schools, state universities like ourselves.
And the medium-sized schools, either public or state.
What about your denominational colleges, of which there are so many?
They still inquire of us, particularly we're a great source of reference for people for jobs. This is, to me, this is most complimentary. But we get any number of inquiries. For example, in the last two or three years, again, let me use some specifics. Our Bill of Student Rights was looked upon as almost a model one. Obviously, we followed the national statement developed by a number of the organizations, plus this National Students Association. But the Purdue one was looked upon as really a very fine model on this. Our document on the regulations governing conduct was looked upon as an excellent document in that direction, if you had to go that direction. A number of us still wish we could go back and do it the other way, where we do it by a counseling method completely. Because we did this successfully here for years and years and years without any lawsuits, without any great repercussions. We felt,
you know, when I went to first conference, the president said, now you're going to ask about college rules and discipline. Says, we have a group of people who were recently in college. They administer our rules. Our rules is this: behave yourself as a gentleman. If you don't know what a gentleman is, you shouldn't be here. If you do know, that's all we care about.
Purdue code. When I came here, and until just a few years ago, I had a statement that Purdue students shall behave themselves, ladies and gentlemen. No further definition of this, using about the same philosophic approach. You should know the difference between right and wrong as a result of your background.
And
this is
respect,
what we expect you,
that,
for law and order and the rights of others. And this was our basic philosophy. But I think that Purdue is looked upon as an excellent system. We get great many inquiries, again, for job placement. We get, my staff members are under fire all the time for other jobs. As a result, there are times when I have fairly high turnover. I think this is good. I think this is excellent. I want new ideas in from other places, and I hope that the Purdue influence is significant in other places also. Our student organization management is looked upon quite highly. It bothers some people at our extreme decentralization. But again, I point out to them, even on their own staffs, the thing that makes any system work is people. And if you have the right people doing the job gets done. If you don't have the right people, I don't care what organizational pattern you have, it isn't going to get done.
Well, now, are the Big Ten schools and these large numbered universities, do they face different problems on a regional basis or on a state basis or tradition?
They're having troubles. I think if you were to review, and I...
For example, let's just take Ohio State.
Ohio State, you see, their pattern of organization probably is more similar to Purdue's than almost any other school in the Big Ten.
Why did they have all this trouble this spring?
Well, environment, I think, is different. They're in a large city with large minority population groups. You inherit some of these things, I think, by omissions.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I've always said is that, you see, any of this dissonance really catches university staff off guard because we aren't geared for combat. We never have been.
This is why the university has been so vulnerable.
This is right.
They cannot exist as participants on one side or the other.
Just take a police force alone.
Yeah.
Here you have a university of 25,000, you have 30-some police. Well, now, obviously, you're not geared to hire, fight and control disruption.
Of course they're not.
And people in the public, then, you see, well, call in the state National Guard, call in the state police.
And you get a Kent State.
And then you get more violence.
That was going to happen, obviously,
yeah.
Sometime.
But,
incidentally, I asked a friend of mine who teaches Russian history here, I said, how long would Moscow or any of the Iron Curtain countries allow dissidents such as we have here? He thought for a moment. He said, well, it wouldn't ever be more than 5 minutes.
Well, look at Prague with the student demonstration.
He said the students either will be put in labor camps, be dismissed from the university at once, or relegated to such a position that they can never distinguish themselves.
I heard a commentary program the other night on Czechoslovakia, and they were talking about the changes in the universities there. And dissidents, you know, there has been suppressed to the point where you don't see anything anymore. But I think if I were to be critical of our professional group, one of the things that we have done that bothers me, and I think maybe we have not dealt fairly with our students in this respect, is I think we went through an era of permissiveness where we didn't tell them maybe clearly enough what we expected. We let a lot of it go by inference. Maybe we didn't start the confrontations. Now, I'm not talking about freedom of speech being suppressed, natural input expression of opinion being heard. This I'm for 100%. But I think when things began to get critical, we maybe sat by, and I'm talking about not just personnel people, but administration, quote unquote, and we thought, oh, gee, these are bright young people. Things aren't going to get this bad. And suddenly, the thing was beyond a point of reclamation. I have a dean friend, for example, that runs, has run over many years, I think one of the best shops in any of the major universities. Good participation by students, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, he was looked upon as probably one of the top deans. Suddenly he gets an import group of minority identification. He has two buildings burned down. He has people trying to go to class nude. He isn't geared for this, you see. So as a result, he goes through about a year and a half to 2 years of chaos. It takes him that long to devise ways and systems and methods of meeting this. As of now, he's back on the right track. There's good freedom of expression on his campus, good input by students, but the line is drawn. You don't go beyond this.
Of course, I heard Fusey of Harvard make a talk in which he said, students who object to ROTC forget that this is a choice made by people. Why, she said, should I deny one student the right to choose ROTC and another one to participate?
This has been exactly our stance, you see.
Yeah. Well, okay. Now, is there something you'd like to put on? I think I pretty well asked you what you... to review the situation.
I have great hope for education, Bob. Again, I'm the product of this kind of a school. I think this is the great future in education. Universities have changed. People who say universities haven't changed and get restive under this, I think don't know what they're talking about. Because just in my experience, and I feel fairly sure that if you talk to most staff people, administrators, and teaching faculty, as they look back over their careers, they would note tremendous changes in universities. University government, university involvement of faculty, development of curricula, the changes in curricula, new programs. I heard a speaker the other day comment upon the role that Purdue was playing, for example, in this field of technology. You're never maybe quite as far out in front as you wish you could be. But then again, maybe you can't be for various reasons. Public reaction, money. Look at our situation here with the vet school. We wouldn't start it until we had the funds to do it right, you see. The School of Humanities was a natural evolvement here. The Division of Science and Engineering. I see the role of us, for example, in preparing teachers. So I have great optimism. There's cycles in every society, and I think we're in a particular kind of society. My only hope is that this radical activism will not produce a backlash that becomes oppressive.
I am told it has produced on the camp among our alumni here a terrible backlash.
This is right.
In which they, in a way, it reflects upon old Purdue because you should, just because a bunch of kids broke into the and seized the dean and roughed him up doesn't mean I'm not going to contribute to my college and
this
so
is right. Well, but I see this, you see, as one of my roles.
Yeah.
I go out and talk to alumni groups. I try to set the scene for them and point out to them that this place hasn't changed that much. It's still a fine university and that their pride should still remain with this school.
Yes, but what happened to Purdue and its educational system that it failed to instill in these people an attitude or understanding that things are going to change?
See, I don't think it failed. I'd be contradictory there because you see when you're
talking about... I want to get you on tape. This is why I...
But when you're talking about the violence, dissident, you see.
Yeah.
You're talking again about a very small number. Now, maybe you had their counterpart 20 years ago, but what did he do? Well, he went out, he was a regular stud with the girls, or he boozed it up. He was a dissident in his own manner in that day. And I had fraternity brothers in the 30s who were dissidents. you see, in that sense. They thought the dean was a son of a bitch. They never saw the president of the University of Illinois, and their idea of fun was to harass him, call him up and ask him if he had any dried oats, and tell him he ought to water them, and this sort of, you know, the typical college monkey business. Today, the dissidence takes a different form, and it's aligned today with what the students see as the problems of society.
And it's identification with, for example, bad treatment of the Indians or bad treatment of the
Blacks
Negro.
Blacks or the Mexicanos or whatever.
I noticed that you've gone, that we have tried to meet the problem of the black by having specially oriented programs and services. You've gone along with this, haven't you?
Absolutely. I believe in it. See, well, I think we're developing a number of facets of this. This postdoctoral or this doctoral awards program they have for blacks, minority students, the hiring of a black coordinator, the development of the black cultural center, the special black counseling offices, the hiring of staff. For example, I'll have another black staff men this next year. I've had several on my staff. I've had three black secretaries. This isn't tokenism. This is a thing I object to, because I would never hire a black for my professional staff just because he was black. He's either going to qualify to do the job that's needed to be done, or I'm not going to hire him. And I don't believe in paying a premium salary just because a man is black. But on the other hand, we can't do anything else but become aggressive in developing programs to help all minority peoples. There are underprivileged, disadvantaged, that are white, come out of the same kinds of areas. We've got to, I think, look at this as a total package, because somehow this is a problem that society has got to solve. And I've been very, very supportive of this, and hope that we continue to make the same kind of progress we're making. I would rather see an institution do the kind of thing that Purdue has been doing, and that is, like through the IM school, through humanities school, we're developing good, solid, constructive educational approaches to this, and not go into a tizzy and let emotionalism rule the day, where you go out and suddenly one year you bring in 1,000 blacks, open admissions, and then have this splatter all over you so that you stand around with egg on your face because you haven't done the job right. Because I think this is destructive to the eventual goal that you have.
Very good. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Well, all I can say is I've enjoyed Purdue. Again, I've been influenced here by, and I guess this is probably a repetition of what everybody else has recorded, but in my book, President Hovde has, I think, been a most outstanding president for this institution. Much of the things that we see here, I'm sure, are traceable directly to this man. Personally, I've enjoyed my relationship with him, because in my book, he's the kind of administrator that I like to work for. This may sound awfully egotistical, but in the years I've been here, he has never reversed me on a disciplined decision. I know he hasn't agreed with me in every case, but I think his philosophy has always been, this is your job, this is your area of expertise. He'll throw in an opinion, but if my feeling is such that I still must insist on my decision, this has been what it is. He's been good, as far as I'm concerned, at letting me have input. Sure, always not maybe as much as I would like, but on the other hand, I think every administrator has to recognize his role within the institution, his level of input. And there are times when there are crises situations or where maybe my role is not as important as I think it is. But I've seen a fine evolvement here. Look at the growth of the administrative structure of this institution. When I came here, two men really basically had primary input to the president. It was R.B. Stewart and Frank Ockham. Today you have a broader framework of administrative involvement, regular dean's meetings, the staff meetings by the vice presidents and the president's senior people. And I think people overlook sometimes the real skills in administration that Hovde has and that he's put across in this institution. And course, R.B. Stewart had great impact, and I have great admiration for him. But I think Purdue has a fine future. I think we're in a good position to grow and develop. Our regional campus structure, I think, has been a significant development in college administration and programming.
They may be autonomous and separate one of these days.
And if this is the best way to go, fine. Okay.
Is there anything more?
I think that's all right now, Bob.
Do you want to pay any comment to any of the other people with whom you work?
I've enjoyed all my relationships. Helen Schliemann, Don Mallett, of course. I think back at the deans I've known here. And in particular, I think one of the most significant things I've enjoyed here is a close working relationship with teaching faculty. I think this has been a very significant difference in Purdue. I have dean friends that I don't think know, and I don't think I'm underestimating too many. I don't think they know 50 teaching faculties, people on their campuses. Where through our committee structure, my involvement here with readmissions, for example, has given me a tremendous avenue of communication with teaching faculty across the campus. Involvement on faculty senate committees, the involvement of faculty here in the orientation program planning, all these things I think are very significant. I think there's a closeness, a warmth within this institution that I hope we never lose, and we better work at keeping it.
Well then,
that's all I have.
Very good. We will call this the end of the interview with Assistant Vice President and Dean of Men, O.D. Roberts. This interview will be used with the Purdue University Archives.